You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. A successful young mother, Kelsey Barrett, vanishes on Thanksgiving Day 2018. The FBI is afraid they'll have to do a deal with the devil to find her. Kelsey, a pilot so good she taught the military how to fly, goes shopping at a Safeway store and simply disappears. Her fiancé, Patrick Frazee, says he doesn't have a clue. In fact, he says they broke up just a few days before. He's as mystified as everyone else. But Kelsey's mother, Cheryl, is afraid she knows what happened to her daughter. A task force of FBI and the Colorado Bureau of Investigation agents believe they also know what happened to Kelsey. They have cell phone records and more, including surveillance video and DNA. But they have run into a roadblock. The agents have to get someone close to the killer to flip and turn state's evidence. Are they going to have to do a deal with the devil to find justice for Kelsey Barrett? The murder of Kelsey Barrett, a shocking true crime story, is a riveting story of a young woman's disappearance, her family's will to find out what happened, and a 21st century police investigation that nearly cracks the case wide open. Nearly. Will the FBI do a deal with the devil to solve this crime? The book that we're featuring this evening is The Murder of Kelsey Barrett, a shocking true crime story, with my special guest, journalist and author, Rod Cackley. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Rod Cackley.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thank you for coming on and talking about your latest, The Murder of Kelsey Barrett. Let's start right away. I won't ask you why you decided to write this book, because it's just obvious. This is such a compelling and incredible story that had a lot of media attention. Let's talk about how you open this book. This is November 22nd, 2018, and we introduced Patrick Frazee, if that's the pronunciation of his name, but there's a Thanksgiving dinner, November 22nd, that they planned. Tell us who all attends this dinner, and just tell us a little bit about Patrick and his relationship with his mother. Tell us a little bit about the characters, Sean, his family, Sheila. Tell us a little bit about these characters that are assembling for November 22nd, 2018.
Sure, Dan. Glad to do it. We've got Sean Frazee, or Frazee. I've always pronounced it Frazee, but I don't know for sure. But Sean Frazee, his mother, Sheila, and Sean's wife are going to be in a Thanksgiving Day dinner. They're waiting for Patrick. Now, Patrick and his mother, Sheila, they live together on a ranch. It's quite a nice ranch. They have horses. They're horse ranchers, basically. Sean is married. He has a wife, kids, and he lives where he works in Colorado Springs. He's a Colorado Springs police officer. Patrick, on the other hand, is single, but he's hooked up with this woman, Kelsey Barrett, who he met online. Sheila lives alone with Patrick. Sheila's husband, Patrick and Sean's father, died in August, just a few months before this dinner. And as we look at the dinner, they are waiting for Patrick to show up. The dinner was supposed to begin at about 3:30. Patrick's not there yet. It's already 4 o'clock.
Right. And now, so they decide to carry on with dinner, and during the dinner, Patrick calls again. Again, he lives with his mother, and he's expected to be there, so people are surprised that he is not there. And also, he's supposed to show up with his fiance and his daughter, his one-year-old daughter, Kaylee. So tell us about the phone call during dinner. What does he say?
Well, the family without Patrick, Kaylee, and Kelsey, they sat down to have dinner. 30 minutes after they sat down, the home's landline rings. It's Patrick. He promised to join them, but he says, "I will be late." Now, Sean's eyes roll. Sean is a family man. He's a police officer. He thinks Patrick's behavior is just outlandish. This is Thanksgiving Day dinner, after all. Sean says he's already late after Sheila, his mother, tells him that Patrick will be there, but he'll be late. He's already late, says Sean, saying he'll be here as soon as possible, Sheila says, and he's bringing little Kaylee, the one-year-old daughter. What about Kelsey? Asks Sean's wife. Sheila looked her way and with a slight smile rolls her eyes and says, no, Kelsey won't be here.
Now, you talked about a little bit about the relationship with Sean and Patrick, and you write that they had been slightly estranged for many years and had gone different paths completely. Tell us a little bit about the relationship between Sheila and Kelsey, and also what Kelsey's mother felt about Patrick.
Yeah, Patrick, well, to begin with, let's talk about Kelsey's mother and Patrick. They don't get along. She can't understand. She doesn't think that Patrick is treating Kelsey right, can't understand why they don't have a place together. They live separately, even though they're engaged. They live separately. Cheryl, his mother, or her mother, Kelsey's mother, thinks they should be living together. The relationship between Kelsey and Sheila, Patrick's mother, is worse, much worse. The first time they meet, Sheila calls Kelsey a prostitute. Then she calls her a hooker. This is bad, right? Now, they were able to work this out a little bit, but they have a bad relationship. Kelsey wants to be part of the family. She can't understand why Sheila's treating her like this. But Sheila just does not want her in her house. She does not want her with her son, Patrick.
Now, regardless of the family animosity there, and Kelsey still wants to make this work and believes that this is the man that's going to be in a relationship. They have a child together. And in fact, on November 20th, a couple days before Thanksgiving, Kelsey sends a text to her boss at Goss Aviation. What exactly does he, or what's the gist of the message to her boss?
Basically, on November 20th, 2 days before Thanksgiving, she tells her boss that she couldn't be happier. And she's very happy, in fact, because Patrick has agreed to go to the company Christmas party with her, something she wasn't expecting.
Right. So that's for all accounts, and she tells her friends as well, whether they believe it or not, that this is she's in love and that she feels very confident about this relationship.
Right.
Now, you introduce another character. And her name is Crystal Lee Kenny, and she's a nurse from Idaho. Now, she has also had a relationship before Kelsey came into the picture. Tell us about this relationship she has with Patrick.
Yeah, Crystal and Patrick go back a long way, pretty much a decade. Crystal met Patrick and started playing around with him while she was married. Patrick got Crystal pregnant. Told her to get an abortion, which she did. Then he told her to get a divorce, which she did, all with the promise, sometimes explicit and sometimes implied, that they would get married and have a life together. They never got married. They never had a life together. They split up. They didn't talk to each other for a couple of years, but Crystal bumped into Patrick, and it all started over again. Even though, by the way, they got divorced, Crystal and her husband, Chad, even though they got divorced, they still live together and raise their kids together, which presents another interesting dynamic in this story.
And the thing is, too, is that he had asked her to get divorced, and they hooked up again. But then he told her, listen, I have met a woman. I'm engaged to be married, and I have a child. And this is all from the woman that he asked to be divorced, asked her to get a divorce, abort a child, change her life. Just to show just the state of mind that for Crystal Lee Kenny to some degree. Now,
yeah,
let's talk about. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, the thing is, she knows it shouldn't be this way. She knows this is a bad relationship, but she just can't say no to Patrick.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about at the same time as this November 22nd Thanksgiving dinner, a neighbor of Kelsey, and this is at, across the street in the same neighborhood as Kelsey's condo, and this is Leslie Jackson, and she has had a situation where she believes that she needs surveillance cameras, so she has a sophisticated three-camera surveillance setup. But one of the cameras is focused on her neighbor's door, which happens to be Kelsey's condo. Now, on Leslie's at her mother's house on Thanksgiving, but the phone has the app connected to this surveillance. So tell us a little bit about what Leslie Jackson just notices while she's at Thanksgiving dinner with her mother.
Yeah, the phone is on the side, and it starts buzzing and humming, and indicating that there's activity on the cameras, and it's taking pictures of what's happening. And as you said, one of the cameras is focused on Kelsey's front door. And so Leslie knows something's going on at the neighbor's house or at her house. But then when she checks the phone, she finds out it's the pictures are all from Kelsey's front door. That's where the action's happening. It's Thanksgiving Day, so she doesn't really look at it too much and doesn't get too concerned about it. Because it is Thanksgiving Day, and she doesn't want to interrupt dinner with her mother, but she can tell that something's going on at Kelsey's front door, at her condo.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is November 25th, 3 days after November 22nd, and Kelsey's mother, Cheryl, and her brother, Clint, Kelsey's brother, Clint, had sent texts, but hadn't heard, and then called, but hadn't heard from Kelsey since November 22nd, from Thanksgiving, from a text that they had received at that time. And I guess that, well, Cheryl had spoken to her daughter earlier, and they had spoken about making cinnamon buns and talking about Thanksgiving itself. So November 25th, now it's December 1st, and Mom, Cheryl has not, and Clint have not heard from her. So what's the conversation December 1st with Cheryl and Clint, and what do they decide to do?
Well, Cheryl and Clint are very close with Kelsey. This is a very tight-knit family, and but they know they have the feeling something's wrong. But then again, see, remember, Kelsey is a pilot. We haven't really touched on that, but she's a pilot, so she often flies and is often gone from her condo for days at a time.
Right.
So they have to, so they don't automatically assume something's wrong, but still they're concerned. So Cheryl reaches out to Clint. Clint flies from his home near Tacoma, Washington, goes to Cheryl's place in northern Idaho. Together, they fly to Colorado and then drive a rental car to Woodland Park to her Concha Kelsey's condo to see for themselves what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do they notice right away, some of the things that they notice right away, unusual for her? So tell us all the things that they notice, just obvious things that they can deduce from going into that condo and taking a look around.
Yeah, they have a key. So they go into this two-bedroom, one-bath condo, and the first thing they notice right away is the thermostat is set at 72 degrees. Cheryl and the brother, Clint, they wonder, now, why would anyone set their thermostat at 72 if they knew they were going to be gone for a few days? Then they look into the kitchen, and they find out, they find, rather, a plate of cinnamon rolls. Remember, as you said, Cheryl and Kelsey had talked about Kelsey making a plate of cinnamon rolls to take over to Sheila and Patrick's house for Thanksgiving Day. The plate of cinnamon rolls is sitting on the counter in the kitchen. No, it's not covered. Why would Kelsey do that if she was leaving for a few days? And the cinnamon rolls are rock hard. They've been sitting there, obviously, since the morning of Thanksgiving Day when they were made. You could hammer nails with these things, Cheryl thought, and Clint said they must have been left out for days. You know that she was making them Thanksgiving morning. Then they go into, they look at the floors, the kitchen. It's perfectly clean. This place is spotless. What young mother, a working mother with a one-year-old girl, is going to have a spotless home? Obviously, they had an intense cleaning in that condo sometime between Thanksgiving Day and the day December 1st that they are there. It's just not like her at all. but at the same time, there are piles of dirty clothes everywhere. So there's this real paradox of what they're finding. They open a closet door in the hallway, and they find Kelsey's luggage. Why would she be gone for a few days, a week, and then leave her luggage in the closet? They go into the bathroom. They find her toothbrush is there. They find her makeup kit is there. All of these signs are showing you that, or showing them rather, that if Kelsey left, she certainly didn't plan to leave and didn't plan to be gone for a long time.
Now, you say that Cheryl doesn't like and doesn't get along with Patrick, but she thinks her next move certainly should be to call Patrick and see what he knows and talk to him. So she certainly gets him on the phone. He answers, tell us about this quite odd conversation.
It was a very odd conversation because Cheryl thinks that, if nothing else, Patrick at least must know where Kelsey is. He doesn't have a clue. As a matter of fact, he says, Cheryl, I would not know because we broke up. And Cheryl says, no, wait a minute. She told me you were going to get married. She was very happy. I talked to her the morning of Thanksgiving Day, and she gave me no clue. And she actually said that you were going to go to the Christmas party, the company Christmas party. And Patrick says, no, I haven't seen her for a couple of weeks and haven't talked to her for a couple of weeks. I have no idea where she is.
Yeah. And so, but she can't believe his response, but she says things like, come on, Patrick, you haven't seen her in 2 weeks, and neither have I or anyone else. All right, but she implores him to help her in searching for this woman that he said he loved, just, and everyone thought they were ready to be married.
Right.
What does he say in response to that?
Yeah. Cheryl says, can't you at least reach out and call her? Call her and find out where she is. Call her and find out if anything's wrong. And Patrick says, I don't think she's going to want to talk to me. And Cheryl says, please, just call Kelsey, the woman the mother of your child. Can't you call her? Mm-hmm. He goes, okay, I'll call her, but I've got to take care of my towels first.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
Now, it was time to call the police as far as Cheryl was concerned.
Absolutely. So she calls Woodland Park Police, and she talks to a Corporal Dina Curran. And so what does Dina Curran do in response to this?
Well, remember, too, when they were in the condo, we should mention they found blood in the bathroom, spots of blood
yes.
in the bathroom. And so now it's definitely time to call the police. Corporal Curran says, well, she calls Patrick and talks to Patrick about Kelsey and can't understand either why he won't call Kelsey. Patrick admits that Cheryl called him a few days ago and told him that she couldn't find Kelsey. Kelsey was not replying to any texts or phone calls. And then Patrick admits to the corporal that we were engaged, but we aren't anymore. We had a real heart-to-heart before Thanksgiving. He sighs and, he gives her the impression that Kelsey dumped him. And the relationship just wasn't working. We're from different backgrounds. It just didn't work out. He says that really it wasn't a lover's quarrel. He returned everything that Kelsey had in his home. He'd given back a gun, an extra car key, and even a handgun to Kelsey. So this raises a flag with Corporal Curran. She asks if either one of them have been depressed. We've got a gun in the mix now. He says no. He explains that they met online on a dating app and sent her a text, he says, on November 25th. And he was looking at it on his phone as he was talking to the police corporal. He wrote, he texted, do you even love me? So he says, told Cheryl he hadn't heard from Kelsey for a couple of weeks. Well, now he's telling the police officer that he texted her and was expecting a response on November 25th.
Right. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages. Now, Rod, we are now December 4th and 2018, and Ray Sebring is the boss at DOS Aviation, and Kelsey hasn't been at work, but he had received a message November 25th, something about she couldn't come in because Grandma was sick. What does he believe when he talks to Cheryl What does he believe about that text released November 25th?
He's not totally suspicious because, as he says, people do get. Now, she called in sick or texted in sick, I guess you could say, called off. And, he says people do get sick. But then he looks at the text, the wording of the text, and Ray says, look at this. Kelsey never puts a comma after my name in a text. She always uses an exclamation point. That wasn't in the text. So right away, she's thinking something's wrong. Because she wrote, her text to him was, hi, Ray, comma, it was a great day, .. Happy Thanksgiving to you, too, read the message. Again, no exclamation point, and she put a comma after his name. So he's thinking that something's wrong there. And again, and she always puts the little smiley faces in that people put in their text sometimes. In this text, there are no smiley faces. So again, that's kind of a red flag to him.
And Cheryl had received text, and again, she didn't believe that it sounded like her daughter at all, did she?
Right. Again, there are. We all have the way that we text, and it's almost like a fingerprint in a way. And the Kelsey's texts suddenly have changed. Cheryl's noticing things that are wrong with the text. And she received a text, for instance, from Kelsey's phone, which read, I'm tied up. I'll call you later. But Kelsey never once told me that Patrick and never once told her, rather, that she and Patrick were having fights or problems.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Woodland Park police had been inside Kelsey's condo, and it presented some problems because they never really found anything there wasn't enough suspicion. Aside from the small drops of blood on the toilet, you say, but there was no forced entry or sign of struggle. But they did research the place, and you say that they left with an iPad, a notebook with passwords, and a Safeway receipt purchased November 22nd. But you say that you write that the Colorado Bureau of Investigation joins the case.
Right. This is where the CBI gets into the case, and this is where it gets really interesting because they bring in technology that was not available to the Woodland Park Police. And part of this technology isn't really technology. It's dogs. They bring in some canine dogs to sniff through the place. There's a 2006 Toyota Corolla and a red Chevy Silverado pickup in the driveway of Kelsey's house or condo. And so they want to do a dog search, a dog trained to find human remains. And they also talked to Cheryl of the agents, Greg Slater and Kevin Torres. They talked to Cheryl for the first time, and she tells them that even when she was younger, she never ran away from home. Kelsey, I mean, I'm referring to Kelsey here. So the fact that she has disappeared is totally, totally, out of bounds for her. But she talks to them, too, about the text messages that she has been getting. She tells the agents that the sentences were all wrong. Kelsey always writes her texts in complete sentences. These messages have incomplete sentences, or the messages have incomplete sentences with a lot of abbreviations that Kelsey never used. So the CBI is getting a little more concerned about this. They go into the Corolla. They don't find anything at the pickup truck. But then they go into the Corolla with this dog, and Lucy is her name, the dog's name, which is like in the 90 to 95 percentile among her canine colleagues for accuracy. This dog just doesn't make mistakes. And she drops right down on the pavement. The dog picks up something from outside that Corolla that shows her that either we've had human remains here of some kind, is what the dog finds.
Yeah. Now, still December 4th, 2018, Patrick's brother, Sean, he's a police officer. Even without that, he knows something is wrong with Patrick. Patrick had called him to meet, which was in itself unusual. And the day before, they had a weird conversation, and Patrick told Sean that Kelsey is missing. So they have a conversation. Tell us about the gist of this conversation between Patrick and Sean.
Yeah, Patrick calls Sean the day before, December 3rd, and tells him, just drops this bombshell that Kelsey is missing out of nowhere. So they arrange to meet. They don't meet at a home. They don't meet at Sean's house. They don't meet at Patrick, where Patrick lives with his mother in the family home. They meet in a parking lot, of all places. So Sean, being a police officer, his suspicions are raised right away. Patrick tells Sean that he and Kelsey have broken up. And Sean says, well, if you've broken up, how do you know that Kelsey's missing if you haven't talked to her, if you haven't been around her? Her mom called, he explains, and Cheryl said no one's seen her since Thanksgiving. Well, now, wait a minute, Sean says, Thanksgiving, didn't you see Kelsey when you picked up Kaylee?
Yeah.
Remember, that was the story on the phone. Okay,
yeah.
Then Patrick's quiet, but he starts breathing very heavily. And, you know, the police officer and Sean knows that this guy is lying. Well, her grandmother was sick, Patrick said. I know that, so she's gone to visit her. And Sean says, wouldn't her mother have known that? I mean, this is really a brother-to-brother sibling interrogation, if you will. I mean, Sean can't help himself. He's a cop. This is what he does. And Patrick, you know the old saying that, you know, how the tangled web we weave when we're first we begin to deceive? This is what Patrick is finding out now. He's getting stuck in this web of lies, in this web of deceit that he started spinning from Thanksgiving Day. Then another police officer shows up. A Woodland Park police officer shows up. He's been looking for Patrick, and he wants his cell phone. You know the cell phones. I mean, you're always being watched. That you can, you have no privacy when you're holding a cell phone. Okay, people can find out where you are by your phone calls. The Woodland Park police officer wants Patrick's phone. Doesn't have a warrant, but he says, this time I'm asking. Next time it'll be different. Sean is a brother police officer, and he advises Patrick just to turn over the phone.
Yeah. December 4th, 2018, you write that Patrick needs a phone. He needed to make a call. So he goes to see his friend, and we didn't introduce his friend yet, Joseph Paul Moore, and he's a cattleman as well. And he considers Patrick like a little brother.
Yeah,
so tell us
he
about
calls him a stepkid, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
tell us about this conversation.
Yeah, Joseph Moore and Patrick go way back, years and years, even longer than Patrick's relationship with Crystal, okay? And so he goes to Joseph's house to borrow a cell phone to use his phone. He says, I need to use your phone. Got to talk to somebody about some horses. Joseph, because they're such good friends, I mean, this is unusual, but he still doesn't hesitate. He hands over the phone to Patrick, but again, he's wondering, who doesn't have a phone these days? And if you lose a phone, don't you just go buy a burner or just get another phone to replace it? Who walks around without a phone and asks to borrow a phone these days? So he gives Patrick the phone anyway and then walks away to give him a little bit of privacy. But he does overhear Patrick say, if I get arrested because they've taken my phone, I'm going to have my friend here call you. It'll be from this number, so come and get these horses. And, of course, he is referring to Joseph because he's on Joseph's phone, right? The person on the other end is a lot more talking than Patrick. So Joseph can't hear that. But obviously, he's getting more and more suspicious, and minutes are clicking by on Joseph's phone. Finally, Patrick slaps the phone shut and gives it back to his friend. Says, thanks, buddy. Gets into his truck and drives away. And that's it. He doesn't say anything more to Joseph. So Joseph starts thinking, who the heck's he calling on my phone? You know, so he looks it up, and he doesn't recognize the number, but he does recognize the area code 208, Idaho, calling somebody in Idaho.
Yeah. Now, the next day, December 5th, 2018, now we're at the credit union in Woodland Park, and Patrick is there. He wants to speak to the manager. Now, what does he want to speak to the manager about December 5th?
Yeah, now this credit union, the Ent Federal Credit Union on Paradise Lodge Lane at Woodland Park, this is where he and Kelsey have accounts. He walks in. He doesn't look nervous, but he wants to talk to the manager. And what he wants is he asks her, is it possible to get a copy of what your surveillance camera recorded on November 22nd? The manager, Patricia, can't understand why he would want that. And he looks at her and says, you know who I am? I mean, who says that? You know who I am?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
She nods, yes. She says, well, I used the ATM that day, and I need to get a copy of the tape to show the police where I was. That way I can prove that they should stop thinking of me as a suspect.
Yeah.
Until his disappearance, he says. And Patricia just can't believe this. She's trying to get this guy out of her office as smoothly and quietly as possible. So she tells him that she says, why would you want that tape? Why would you need to show the police where you were on November 22nd if Kelsey had talked to her mom 3 days after that on the 25th? Because he told her that Kelsey called her mom on the 25th. And so she knows something's wrong here. She's really tense. And she sees this rage flash through Patrick's face. Now, other people have mentioned this, too, that he just flips a trigger, flips a switch and pulls a trigger, and he just gets intensely angry. And she sees it, and she backs up. And all she wants now is to get him out of there before she gets hurt. And she explains to him that the tape is no good. They recycle the tapes every day, so there's no evidence of what was happening on November 22nd. And finally he leaves. He slams the door, pulls the door open, yanks the door open, lets it slam behind him, gets in his car, slams the door shut, and speeds off. Well, Patricia, the bank manager, the credit union manager, she calls the police right away. And as soon as the detective picks up, she says, you aren't going to believe who was just here.
Yeah. Now, you talk about still days later, Tanya Atkinson, the crime scene analyst from Colorado Bureau of Investigation, spends the afternoon looking for bloodstains in the condo. There's also, she realizes, the bath mat is missing. The fridge has been wiped down and does various tests in the washroom itself. Bloodstains found throughout the bathroom, blood everywhere, basically. And determined that it's likely foul play. Now, on December 11th, Patrick now is, again, desperate. He goes to the Verizon store. And, again, he says, you know who I am, right? And what does he ask the people at the Verizon store to do?
He talks to a guy by the name of David Fellers, and he's scaring the heck out of this guy, just like he did with Patricia. But what he wants to know is, if you smash a cell phone up, does that ruin it? Does that make it so that nobody can tell who you've talked to? Does that ruin the system that records who you've talked to? And David says, what? He says, well, can I see your phone? And Patrick says, well, I don't have the phone with me. The phone's not here? David says, he tells Patrick that he can't do anything without the PIN number. But now, David knows who Patrick is, too. He knows this is a guy. Everybody knows everything in Woodland Park about this case. And so Patrick says, now, if I had a busted-up phone, if it was broken or damaged, like somebody smashed it with a hammer, would you be able to get information off of it, like a call record or something? And David says, I really can't tell you anything without that PIN. So then he says, will you excuse me, David? David says, will you excuse me? I have to use the bathroom. So he just goes into the bathroom and locks the door and sits in the door in the bathroom praying that Patrick will just leave, which he does. Patrick finally gets tired of waiting and just takes off. So David grabs his phone, still in the bathroom, mind you, and calls the police and says, Patrick Frazee was just here, and tells the cop what happened, the cop on the phone, and the police officer says, well, you'll be getting a call from somebody at the district attorney's office. I can guarantee you that. So, again, Patrick, you know, he's trying to get out of this. He's trying to build an alibi for himself or you know, but every step he takes, he's just stepping in deeper and deeper into this problem.
Absolutely. Now, meanwhile, we talked about this 21st century approach with the FBI and the CBI, and you write about this Cellebrite technology. Tell us about this technology and what they do to be what they are able to determine as a result of this using this technology.
Yeah, Cellebrite is from an Israeli digital intelligence company. It's a subsidiary of Sun Corporation in Japan. They've got a U.S. Division, and what this Cellebrite technology does. It lets police get into cell phones, drones, computers to pull out info, okay? So nothing, again, is private. Now, they've got Patrick's cell phone, and so they can use this Cellebrite technology on this to find out who he's been calling, but more importantly, where the phone was used. So they can look at November 21st, for instance. There's an indication of movement. Oh, they're looking at the cameras, too. They also have the cameras from the neighbor's home. So they're looking at the pictures there. But this Cellebrite technology shows them exactly where Patrick's phone was, and it will show them, too, where Kelsey's phone was.
Now, with that as well, they have found some interesting things about the location of Crystal's phone and of Kelsey's phone. So tell us about what they determined from this about those phones and their locations.
Yeah, with the with Crystal's and Kelsey's phone, they find that somehow Kelsey's phone is going toward Idaho. You know, with the towers that it clicks off of, they see that Kelsey's phone is going toward Idaho, and it was last used in a in an area that is totally isolated, totally remote, and would have had to gone off of a gully. So she would have had to make this call and then just simply vanish from the middle of nowhere.
And she had also said that she was having a conversation, that Crystal was having a conversation with Patrick, or pardon me, that wasn't having a conversation, that they had spent the day together on the 24th, and then on the 25th they had departed, or she had left. So that lend no credence to what they were saying. And in fact, they were putting the phone, Kelsey's phone, with Crystal, putting those two people together, whereas obviously Kelsey and Crystal were not together in the same vehicle, and that obviously she was not able to be with Patrick on November 24th and actually be on the telephone at the same time.
Yeah, right. You see, the thing is, she said that, now this is, let's jump over to December 14th. The FBI is talking to her. They're very interested in Crystal and what she remembers about the 24th of November. Now, the FBI, there are two FBI agents in the room with Crystal, and they're interviewing her back and forth, So she really is unsettled. But she's got this story that she and Patrick worked out together that just is not making any sense because it doesn't jive with what they've learned about the phones from the cell phone towers as to where she was. Mm-hmm. For instance, she says that she was on the, she was with Patrick in his house most of the day, but they have phone records that show she called Patrick and they had a phone conversation. And when was the last time you had a phone conversation with someone you were in the same house with?
Yeah. She was asked even if she ever had met Kelsey. And what was her response?
Yeah, she said she never met Kelsey, didn't even know anything about her, didn't know her name, as a matter of fact. As she put it to the FBI, never. I didn't even know she existed until I started reading the stories about her disappearance. One of the FBI agents said, but you knew Patrick had a daughter with another woman. Sure. And then another agent says, and you never thought even once to ask the man you love to tell you the name of the mother of his child? So, again, they're getting her, they're trapping her here. They're, you know, this is a very pleasant conversation, but the questions get nailed deeper and deeper. I mean, the coffin nails just go deeper and deeper every time she answers.
Yeah, so they get her to lie and mislead police completely, and then she's wedded to those statements. After this interview, though, it was masterful, I believe, because Crystal thinks and tells Patrick what about the interrogation?
She says, no worries. She says she aced it. They've got nothing on us. No worries. She said that she handled it beautifully. They let her believe that she handled it beautifully. But, you know, the agents say, point out that Patrick and Crystal spoke on the phone three times the morning of November 24th and two more times that afternoon. However, Crystal told the FBI that she and Patrick had been together at his house that day. And again, the FBI says, now, when was the last time you picked up a phone and called somebody who they were in the same house with you? It shows Crystal's phone was connected to the tower at the Colorado-Utah border at 4:13 a.m. at 4:17 a.m. and 4:23 a.m. on November 25th. And guess whose phone was connected to the same tower way out in the middle of nowhere? Patrick's? No, Kelsey's. So she had Kelsey's phone on her way out in the middle of nowhere on November 25th. even though she told the FBI she had never met Kelsey. So the two of them couldn't have been in the black car. She borrowed a car, a black car. So the two of them could not have been in a car together. They couldn't have been with each other. She didn't even know her on November 25th, supposedly. But actually, they were out in the middle of nowhere at the Colorado-Idaho border. At least Kelsey's phone was out in the middle of nowhere at the Colorado-Idaho border.
Mm-hmm. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is Ritual. Do you really know what's in your multivitamin? Sugars, GMOs, synthetic fillers, artificial colorants, not to mention animal byproducts like sheep's wool and gelatin from hooves and hides. They're all ingredients you might find in a multivitamin. But Ritual isn't your typical multivitamin. Ritual's clean, vegan-friendly formula is made with key nutrients, in forms your body can actually use. No shady extras. My wife Lisa decided to try Ritual's Essential for Women about 9 months ago. She visited Ritual's site and read about their unique approach to a woman's multivitamin and was impressed with Ritual's research into better vitamin and mineral sources as compared to other multivitamins. She decided to incorporate Ritual into her daily routine of healthy eating and exercise. She believes Ritual has made a significant difference. And now that Ritual has developed Ritual for Men Plus 50, I've started taking Ritual for the same reasons Lisa has. Ritual is a better multivitamin. Now available for women, men, and teens, Ritual multivitamins, including their best-selling prenatal, are scientifically developed to help support different life stages. Your multivitamins are delivered to your door every month with free shipping always. You can start, snooze, or cancel your subscription anytime. And if you don't love Ritual within your first month, they'll refund your first order. You deserve to know what's in your multivitamin. That's why Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder to start your Ritual today. Now, we talked about the law closing in on Patrick and Crystal. And so there was other people that came forward and in their investigation. And that was, they spoke to somebody, the ex-husband of Crystal, and that's Chad Lee. What did Chad Lee have to say to officials and authorities about his wife?
Now, Chad, this is a really interesting dynamic because, as we said, he's divorced. He's the ex-husband, but he and Crystal and their children all live together. They raise the kids together. So he obviously has quite an interest, maybe more of an interest than the average ex-husband would have in the ex-wife. He knows that something's going on, and that's why he was more than happy to talk to the FBI. And he says, Crystal lied to me about what she was doing those 2 days, November 24th and November 25th. The FBI guys are very interested. Now, Crystal told him that she was going to a friend's house for a birthday party those days, but then she changed her story and said she was going to another house, the home of Megan Garrison, another a friend. Both of these women, all these women live in Idaho, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that's important because remember where the cell phone was. And then this is where Crystal borrows a car, and for some reason she needs another car. She can't use hers. She's always coming up with new stories, Chad says. She swore this was the truth. She told me that she was really in Colorado looking at a horse with Patrick. So, again, she said that she was with her friends, but now she says she was with Patrick looking at a horse. And they own this horse together, Chad says, so that part is believable. But Crystal also told him that somebody had set her up. And what she mean by that? She says there's a whole new set of lies, you see, that Crystal is telling. Just like Patrick is telling all these lies, Crystal is telling all of these lies. But that really isn't that unusual for her, that Chad says.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Then we get into her phone and whether she has a Verizon phone or a Samsung phone. There's all these different flags of suspicion that are being raised for the FBI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they realized that the same day the agents seized Patrick's phone, Crystal had used that phone while speaking to an FBI agent about the case itself. So she was busted with that phone, and she purchased a new one on December 4th. So right at that odd timing. Now you write that it is time to bring, now that the authorities have much more information, they've spoke to Chad Lee and they've also spoke to Crystal and they know what's true and what isn't, basically, it was time to bring Crystal Lee in again. So how do things change this time in the interrogation or interviewing?
This time, you know, December 20th, 2018, they have a lot of evidence, but it's all circumstantial. They really cannot, and they don't have a body. That's a really important part of the story. They do not have a body, which makes it even tougher to prosecute a homicide, obviously. The FBI is ready to do a plea bargain, but to do a plea bargain, they have to get Crystal to admit to what happened. So they sit down with Crystal and her attorney, wondering, of course, how forthcoming she'll be. But this is where they really show Crystal that they know she lied. This is where the FBI lays more cards on the table. And this is where they get her to talk and talk not only about what she did, but her history with Patrick and Kelsey.
What does she tell? I mean, they've hearing things from other witnesses as well. They have a Michelle Stein that has said some things, and as the investigation goes, they're hearing about what Patrick had said to Crystal about the potential murder of Kelsey. What does she, Crystal, tell the authorities about Patrick asking and requesting for her to kill, and some of those details?
Yeah, Patrick at least twice, probably three times, asked Crystal to kill Kelsey, according to Crystal. One time he told her to buy a cell phone that couldn't be traced back, called it a burner phone. He explained how he could kill, how she could kill Kelsey. One idea was to put poison in Kelsey's coffee. She loved Starbucks coffee. And so they figured as long as she had a coffee, or Patrick figured as long as she had coffee, she would drink it. Crystal couldn't do that. Then he gave her a pipe, a steel pipe, to beat her to death with. And she actually went and sat across the street from Kelsey's condo and watched Kelsey get out of her car and go into the condo. But Crystal just couldn't bring herself to go over there and beat Kelsey to death with a metal pipe. Then, so she brings the pipe back to Patrick. He gives her a baseball bat and says, do it with the baseball bat, if that makes you feel better. And he says, after you use the bat, just drag the body out to the dumpster or figure some other way to get rid of it. Well, Crystal didn't do that. Again, she goes to Kelsey's house, and she's got the bat, and she sits on the curb across the street from the front door, and all she can think about is, how did I get into this mess? How did I get here? And she goes back to Patrick, explains that she couldn't do it, that she couldn't kill Kelsey, and he says, well, you must have a softer heart than I have, or a bigger heart than I have.
Yeah, what is he referring to in terms of what were the reasons for Patrick wanting to kill Kelsey? How did he justify the reasons for killing her?
He said that Kelsey was abusing Kaylee. Crystal told the FBI that he told her that Kelsey had actually hit Kaylee with an iron, you know, a clothing iron. And so he is saying that she's abusing the kid, and he has to get that kid out of there to save her from this abuse.
Now, part of this plea agreement, if they're going to have a plea agreement, and they need her for this plea agreement because there is no body, and they need this kind of witness, and they know, they believe that they can get the information from her, and that's what this plea bargain is. The attorney has met with her, and she has revealed certain information to that attorney. Now, they want to know, and they need to know, details of the actual murder itself. And so she gives a graphic account of what actually happened, the actual murder, to these police at that time, doesn't she?
Yeah, because Patrick told her what happened. Patrick wanted her to go clean up Kelsey's condo, where she found all kinds of evidence But yeah, Patrick told her that what he did was to put a sweater around Kelsey's face and say that they were going to play a game, that he would light different scented candles, and that then she would say what scent it was or what candle it was. Kelsey, again, this is a case of Kelsey thinking something's wrong here. This is kind of weird. But she doesn't say no to Patrick, because if there's anything that Kelsey has in common with Crystal, it's that she can't say no to Patrick. So Patrick puts a sweater around her face to blind her eyes, lights a candle, then steps back. Kelsey steps back, comes back in with a baseball bat, and starts beating her to death with the baseball bat.
When he was beating her with this baseball bat, previous for her to find this information out, Crystal was assigned to go to Kelsey's condo. She knew where it was, obviously. She'd been outside. To go
mm-hmm.
there with the complete outfit to clean up. She knew that she was going to clean up something like murder. She was a nurse. She knew from all the blood that was all over the place. But he had instructed her, because of the baseball bat beating, to look for something specifically that he may have lost. What was that? And what did already CBI and FBI agents already have in their possession?
He told her to find a tooth. He was afraid that one of the teeth that he had knocked out of Kelsey's head had fallen down an air vent. Mm-hmm. And Crystal did find it. As she says to the FBI, she found the tooth, root and all. So, I mean, he knocked it completely out of her head. The agents believed that because they had searched the house, Sheila's house, where she and Patrick were living. And now Kaylee, by the way, is living there, too. They found an envelope with four teeth in it.
Yeah. Now, with this plea agreement, it's amazing the restraint that these the district attorney has, these authorities have, when they're listening to this tale, they're asking her for, again, clarification, that they are going to have a deal. And she is crying and she's emotional, but they are trying to find out how on earth and why on earth she didn't go to the authorities before all of this. How could she have lived with this, don't they?
Yeah, they do. They can't understand that. And Crystal composes herself and looks at them and says, but I left you clues. She shouted, as a matter of fact, as she stood up from her chair, I left blood on the toilet and on the rock face around the fireplace. Didn't you find it? I left you clues.
Now, also, December 20th, 2018, we go back to Joseph Paul Moore. And while Patrick is still in his desperate state, he contacts his good friend, Joseph Paul Moore. And maybe this is the time now for what he does say to Joseph Paul Moore, and then Joseph Paul Moore contemplating some of the bizarre conversations he's had since 2016 regarding Kelsey.
Yeah, to begin with, he starts babbling. They're driving together, about an hour and a half drive to see some horses, and Patrick says she might have gone up north to Pike to kill herself. And Joseph says, "Who? What? Pike? What are you talking about? Where did this come from? What do you think? I'm saying that she could have driven up to Pike or even Isabel National Forest and killed herself in the woods. You could die in the woods and they wouldn't find you for years, for hundreds of years, maybe 1,000 years before they found you." And Joseph doesn't understand what he's talking about. But then he knows. He's been reading the paper. I mean, they've had reports on this in the paper and the TV. And Joseph says the cops got a ping off her cell phone from a cell tower in Idaho. Why would Kelsey go to Idaho and then back to Colorado and go into the forest to commit suicide? Why didn't she just end it all in Idaho? And you know what was different there, too? He called her Kelsey. Now, that was the first time back when Joseph and Patrick would talk about Kelsey, they never used her name. Patrick would only refer to her as Kaylee's mother or Kaylee's mom. And so, you know, Patrick is just – and then Patrick looks at him and says – you know, her blood might be on me, Kaylee Joe's mother. I might have her blood on me. And Joseph said, okay, well, why would her blood be on you? Well, she had a nosebleed. She started spitting out, and she had a nosebleed and got her blood on my pants and shirts and boots. Heck of a nosebleed, right? Then he says, can the cops find blood in clothes after they've gone through the washer and dryer? And Joseph says, you know, the cops can find blood anywhere. And he was more right about that than he knew, because that's exactly what they did with their new technology. He says to Patrick, with their new technology, cops can even find blood where people can't see it. And, you know, that is exactly what happened. And Joseph said, I just hope we find Kaylee Jo's mom and that she's okay. There was silence. Patrick didn't say a word to that. But then he turns to Joseph and says, why is the FBI even on this case? Why the investigation? There's no body. How can there even be a crime? And why are they even after me? Why do they? What do they think they're going to find? A couple days later, he's still frantic. I mean, he's frantic. He's totally paranoid. And he calls Joseph and says, do you think our phone calls are taped? Are we being recorded? And Joseph says, why would we be doing that? And then Patrick says, now this is a weird question. Is anything disrupted by the red barn? Joseph says, disrupted? What are you talking about? So you can see the conversation, he's getting so frantic. He's losing touch with reality in a way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he also said a very important quote at the end, too. Man, if I'd known it would have blown up this big, I never would have. And he just didn't continue. He just, that was the end of it.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Now, December 21st, we have Crystal, is now going to show investigators how she and Patrick on the family ranch in Florissant disposed of Kelsey's body. So now there is more information to find out on terms of the disposal of the body. So they take her, she's taken to the farm, Patrick and, Sheila's farm, the family farm. What does she show them there?
Yeah, she shows them exactly what they did. She shows them the spot where Patrick, they had a black bag, a black tote bag that was holding Kelsey's body. And Crystal says that together, she and Patrick picked that black tote bag up and took it over to a burn trough. And she tells the cops, she says, I could feel the body in there. She knew there was a human body in that black tote bag. And Patrick told her and she also knew that the baseball bat that he used to kill Kelsey was in that thing as well. The tote's about 5 feet long, weighs at least 100 pounds. They set it on the ground, and then the six garbage bags of evidence that she took out of Kelsey's condo, that Crystal took out of Kelsey's condo, they put that in the burn trough as well. And they light the whole thing on fire. It's a galvanized steel tank about 2 feet wide and 4 feet long. They pick up some wood from a pile of scrap, and they use that for kindling. They pour some gas. They have a few drops of gas in a gas can, and then they dump some motor oil on it, and they light the thing up. Now, here's the problem. It just explodes on them. The flames are way too high. The last thing they want. Now, this is all on Patrick's family ranch, okay? This is the Frazee family ranch. The last thing they want is for anyone to see flames and black smoke. You know how motor oil burns. They don't want flames and black smoke to be seen from the road. Obviously, somebody's going to think something's wrong on the ranch, and they're going to call the police or the fire, or at the very least, they're going to come over to investigate. So then Patrick and Crystal find some big pieces of corrugated metal tin, you know, that you might find on the top of a pole barn, and they use that to kind of tamp the fire down, at least to keep the flames from shooting up and the flame and the smoke from shooting up.
Yes, what's most disturbing, though, and it's right out of a horror movie, is that Crystal looks around and realizes somebody, as actually you just mentioned, you know, they're trying to evade anybody seeing what they're doing. But somebody does see. Who is that?
Yeah. Crystal looks behind her, and she sees a woman. Somebody is looking at her. It's a woman. And you're never going to believe who it is. It's Patrick's mother, Sheila. She's watched the whole thing.
Incredible. You take us now to the agents escort Crystal to Kelsey's condo. And there they have 17 minutes of a graphic description of events there. And as you write, by that time they've had enough. But there is one other thing where the body was kept. and we talk about that red barn again. What was said by Crystal, and what was verified by Lucy and her dog handler?
Yeah, the actually, this time it was another dog, Radar. And I'm a dog
right.
owner, so I want to get the names of the dogs correct here. But,
right.
Patrick told Kelsey, or Crystal rather, that he had stored the body in a red barn, a red barn that he leases on a different piece of property. And he, this was quite a thing. Now, remember, this tote bag is 5 feet long. It weighs 100 pounds. He put it over his shoulder, climbed up some ladders, and put it on top of a bale of hay. And so she tells the CBI and the FBI that they get the canine dog Radar out to look. And it was his handler said he had quite a problem following the dog because the dog's scrambling up the ladder in the hay bales like nobody's business. And he had a tough time. But the dog had a hit right on top of that hay bale. So they knew that the tote bag holding Kelsey must have been on top of that hay bale. And that's where he stored it.
Yeah. Now, there is time for an arrest, and the prosecutors are able to convince the judge that Kelsey was indeed dead, even though they couldn't produce a body. And then Patrick's officially suspected of first-degree murder. And in another week, he would be charged with tampering with a deceased human being, a human body. Now, just tell us a little bit about the arrest. And you say that there was no media there. Was that a surprise for Patrick?
Yeah, Patrick really thought that because of the attention that this case had garnered in on CNN, it's a national story, he wasn't surprised when the police showed up and arrested him. He was surprised when he stepped on the front porch of his house and there was not a single reporter outside. He almost seems to be a little bit disappointed that he was not, that there wasn't a crowd of reporters outside.
Right. Now, as well, this is unusual for this Teller County. You say it's the first murder in the community since 2013. So it's a big deal there.
Yeah, right. You would think that the local paper would show up, but nobody has shown up. Actually, the reporters are all waiting for a press conference. A press conference will be held, and they'll get the information there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say, you write at this time that the biggest challenge for prosecutors is what? What's the biggest challenge for the jury and for this trial itself?
They don't have a body to present to the jury. That's the biggest problem. They really cannot, at this point, they still can't prove that Kelsey is dead.
And as well, they also have the hurdle because he's giving... We haven't mentioned the details of this plea bargain, but her culpability in this is going to be open for criticism. So her credibility at this trial as the star witness is crucial, isn't it?
Yeah, Crystal is going to get off with 3 years. That's the plea deal. Now, Patrick, we should say, too, that Patrick is looking at death. He could get the death penalty. They decide not to go that way. They decide to go with life without parole. But Crystal is getting off with 3 years. So obviously, Patrick's attorney, a public defender, is going to point that out to the jury and make the point that, and try to make the point that the only reason you're testifying is to get off with the three-year penalty.
Patrick meets with his attorneys, and he's totally surprised that there is no wiggle room for him. They say, well, okay, the death penalty is off the table, but you're going to be looking at life without parole. So as you write after that, that he decides to take the initiative and make sure his lawyers have more ammunition to win this case. What is his plan, and who does he meet?
He meets a fellow inmate at the Teller County Jail, a guy by the name of Jacob, and who has, figures has gang connections or knows how to get it done, and he wants Jacob to kill the witnesses. He wants him to kill Cheryl, and he actually even wants him to kill Crystal. He wants him to kill anyone who might testify against him at that trial.
Right.
And you know, his attorneys also, I wanted to mention too, his attorneys told him that they were not going to present any witnesses in his defense.
Mm-hmm.
And Patrick says, well, what about character witnesses?
Yeah.
And the attorney looks at him and says, honestly, we have not been able to find one person in Woodland Park who doesn't believe that you're capable of murder.
Yeah, incredible. And how does he communicate? Like, they have a conversation somehow in this prison, and so he tells them, listen, you're my best shot. He believes that this gang member, because he is a gang member, is unlike the other guys in this little Teller County. He's not in a federal prison, so he has to look for people that he believes have the ability to do this kind of murderous conspiracy for him to take out all these people. And he's even offering them, well, whatever I can give you. He's also claimed to this Jacob Bentley person, when the guy asked him, did you smoke your wife? He says, no, I'm innocent. I didn't have anything to do with it. I don't know where she is. You have to help me. It's me and my daughter. So, but how does he communicate with this Jacob Bentley, which ends up being fortuitous for the prosecution?
He passes him notes. He's like a kid in school passing notes. But the problem is he's written everything down on the notes. So it's all there. And I've seen pictures of these notes, and it's all scribbles and stuff. And he definitely wrote out instructions to Jacob Bentley of how to do this. He not only gave him a list of the people to kill, he wrote down ideas on how to dispose of the bodies and how to take them out to the desert.
Yeah. Now,
and so Jacob keeps all these notes. Not only is he an experienced criminal, he's an experienced convict who knows what it takes to get off or to get a plea deal of his own.
Mm-hmm. Now, you write that it takes about a year, almost a year, for this trial to come to, or for it to get to trial. And we're talking about November 2019. And, of course, as I mentioned, Crystal is the star witness for this. And on the fourth day of trial, she takes the stand. What does she say, and how does she fare on the stand during this trial?
This is a rough appearance. Now, remember, the only hope the defense has in this is to poke holes in the prosecution case. They have no witnesses.
Right.
They have no character witnesses. All they can do is poke holes. And the prosecution's case pretty much is based on Crystal Lee Kenny and her testimony. They don't have a hope. So, you know, and the defense attorney just puts it to her, saying, the only reason you're doing this is to get off. Isn't that right? And if you were so bothered by Kelsey's murder, then why didn't you call the police? Again, he's putting it to her. Why didn't you call the police? It's a rough time on the stand for Kelsey, or for Crystal, rather.
And they also have, before this and during this trial, they've also shown the video of Crystal helping out authorities, tell them how they burnt the body, disposed of the body. Every graphic detail has already been shown to the jury, and then she goes up on that stand and has to repeat that and face cross-examination.
Yeah,
but
and
how
it's
does
not
she...
only... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, how does she fare on the stand during that kind of questioning, relatively?
Well, you know, she did enough to convince the jury that she was telling the truth as she saw it. But she really, this is where her morality really came into play and questions of her morality. And she had a tough time on that witness stand. She really did.
Now, you talk about Jacob contacting prosecution. This wasn't as important to prosecution, but what did it help them in any way other than just adding to further charges other than the murder itself and charges related to the murder?
Right. No, it really did not help them as to charges related to the murder because he didn't admit anything. But mm-hmm. Jacob, being the experienced convict and criminal he was, he says he knew that you could tell now that Patrick had killed Kelsey.
Yeah. And he was also contracted to kill the district attorney, Dan May, several members of the FBI, the CBI.
Mm-hmm.
He was Crystal. Chad Lee, Michelle Stein, Joseph Moore, his partner Wendy Clark, and along with Cheryl Barrett. So many people he wanted killed, and he believed, and he was deluded, mind you, but he believed that there was the ability to do that as his desperation grew and grew.
Yeah, and you know, that's a good word, desperation. That's what you see developing through this story all along, is just Patrick becomes more and more desperate.
Now, what happens with this trial itself? It was 4 hours of deliberation, and that worries the defense attorneys. They didn't call any witnesses whatsoever. They made their summations. It was a fiery tirade, I guess, or summation to the jury. However, 4 hours deliberation means usually not. It doesn't fare too well for the defendant, does it?
No, it doesn't. And in this case, that's the truth. Six men and six women, they left after less than 4 hours of deliberations, and that includes a break for lunch. So it was way less, probably 3 hours of deliberations, and the jury's back. The excitement was palpable. I mean, this is the biggest case Teller County has had in, like, forever, probably. And Patrick is very emotional. Through this trial, through the days of this trial, he was very unemotional. He really fixed his gaze on the witnesses, on the jury. I mean, he tried to use this Rasputin, Svengali kind of attitude that he had, his ability to get people to do what he wanted. He tried to use that that psychology on the witnesses and for the prosecution and on the jury itself. And here, now, when the jury comes back and he's told to stand for the reading of the verdict, he almost loses it. He almost starts crying. But then he just pulls himself together and gets control of himself again. And the tension in the room is just incredible because, remember, they don't have a body. There's nothing guaranteed here.
Yeah. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, you talked about his stoic attitude towards this sentencing, not wanting to show people that this bothered him. He's going to be sent to Colorado prison. His appeals, of course, will go through. But what about Kaylee? Where did Kaylee go? Who has custody of Kaylee? Tell us about that.
Cheryl has custody of Kaylee. If there's, one of Cheryl's big concerns was that Patrick's family would get Kaylee. She did not want that to happen. The prosecution did not want that to happen either. So Kaylee went to Cheryl, and Cheryl will raise Kaylee.
Mm-hmm. And you say one of the worst things about this will be that someday she'll realize that her father killed her mother and that she was present for that murder.
Yeah, that's what Cheryl said. She said that, you know, the child is years away from understanding what's happened to her mother now, but someday she will have to explain what happened. She says Kaylee will eventually, and the thing is, too, we didn't mention this, but when Kelsey was beaten to death with that baseball bat in her condo, Kaylee, mm-hmm. little Kaylee, one-year-old Kaylee, was in the next room.
Yeah.
And then Patrick took her and drove her to his ranch. So, and Cheryl says someday she's going to have to know, she will realize that she was in the next room while her mother was beaten to death.
Yeah. And the judge admonished for his crime, said you burned, you know, Kelsey's body like trash. But also, you mentioned prosecutor Danny May said, we did a deal with the devil, and I'm not proud of that. But Kelsey wouldn't have had justice without it.
You're right. You're right. I think that's the way it is. Plea bargains are never nice things. No one's ever happy with them. But in this case, Kelsey would not have had justice. You're right. Cheryl and her family would not have had justice. As Dan May put it, we did a deal with the devil, and I'm not proud of that, but Kelsey would not have had justice today without making that deal with the devil.
And, you know, to their credit, the defense did negotiate a very good deal for, because I think knowing all these details, as anyone that's listened and anyone especially that reads this will know, the culpability of her. She could have walked away many, many times. It seems quite convenient that her responses and her sobbing and all that, it doesn't seem as genuine when you realize all of the things that she was privy to and didn't do a damn thing. And her only excuse can be that, oh, I couldn't say no to Patrick, which is pretty weak. Now, in that vein, she was sentenced to 3 years in custody, and you say she likely won't even do that. But after 60 days, what did she remarkably, incredibly attempt to do?
Well, she was moved to a halfway house 60 days after she got put in jail. But then she tried to get out early because of the COVID-19 outbreak. You know, she said
right.
being held in close confines of a prison cell, the COVID-19 is more transmissible that way. And remember, she's a nurse. So she said, being a nurse, hey, I should be one of the frontline workers here. I should get out
sure.
of prison so that I could help these people. But, no, you know, you said a lot about Crystal there, Dan. You know, she could have dropped a dime at any time. She was so involved with it, she could have dropped a dime at any time. And the thing is that really gets me about this story is Kelsey did not have to die. And I'm not talking about just from November 22nd on. I'm saying that those three times that Patrick wanted Crystal to kill Kelsey, if she had dropped
right.
a dime back then, none of this would have happened.
Yeah, and Joseph Moore actually, by the time he calls police, he has heard some bizarre things that should have, well, more than raised flags, the kind of statements that Patrick said regarding his child and his wife.
Oh, yeah.
Not
especially,
that you would know.
Yeah.
Yeah, not that you would know, but there certainly were certain things that most people, or definitely most people, would not say. So there were warning flags for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Now,
hey, let's not forget about Sheila. I mean, let's not forget about Sheila.
Exactly.
For Pete's sake, his mother watches the burning, and she knew what it was, too. I'm convinced that she knew exactly what happened.
What we didn't mention was, a bizarre, very vivid scene in here, is when investigators were looking into this and possibly anyone else's role, they investigated a Facebook post with a Wizard of Oz theme. What was it about the Wizard of Oz theme that interested investigators?
Because Sheila posted, yay, yay, the witch is dead. And it was posted on November 25th.
Yeah. Was there any, I mean, you don't write about any talk about any action towards Sheila for what she may have known. I mean, after Crystal said that she did see Sheila witnessing.
Right. No, I didn't find anything related to Sheila at all. I mean, I went through all the search warrants, all the information that's in the search warrants, every single one of them, and there was never any mention of Sheila being culpable in this.
Yeah, incredible. And you write about, too, as well, is that when Crystal was applying to go to a halfway house, a woman named Kelly Schaufstall launched a change.org petition drive to support the block of Kelly's transfer, Crystal's transfer. 45 people signed initially in 48 hours, you write. By the end, it was 8,700 people in the 4 days objected to Crystal Lee Kenny getting out earlier, and then she will already be eligible to get out. When is she eligible for placement in the halfway house again?
By the end of 2020. So obviously that could have happened now, and I honestly don't know where she is now.
Well, it doesn't mean she did get parole, but she does have that
right.
ability to go to a halfway house, only that potentiality by the end of 2020. So yeah, so she, who knows, right? But public pressure
yeah.
always helps in this regard, doesn't it? When people are
it does,
adamant.
And it's, yeah, and you know, and the thing is, Cheryl, the way that Cheryl did, I've written so many books where the mother is in this kind of a situation and just keeps pushing and pushing the police. And the response of the police, I think, in this story was tremendous, as well Dan May and the prosecutors of the district attorney, and what they did in the story, I think, is laudable as well. And they were right there, too, when they argued to keep Crystal in custody and not to let her out.
Yeah. You know, and the thing is, it's amazing as well, because you really have this the potential between these two people for further mayhem was it's interesting that they are almost acted like a partnership, Crystal and Patrick, him being sociopathic, easily to be determined, and yet when there was a deal to be made, I thought a lot of her excuses were very convenient. We easily could have been doing a profile on two psychopathic serial killers if we were to take some of their own rationalizing for the murder itself, if we took that out of the equation.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think both of these people, Patrick and Crystal, I think they both have those tendencies. They just can't appreciate the pain that others feel, which I think is kind of the foundation of a sociopath, where they can't empathize with that kind of pain. They just don't get it. They don't see anybody except themselves in what they want. Even Jacob Bentley thought that Patrick was nuts, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, it's very interesting for somebody, again, Patrick totally misjudged this character, and thinking that because he had gang affiliations that he would go along with this. Again, at the same time, he wasn't facing anything very, very serious, but it looked like he wanted to put this as a little assurance or insurance for himself down the road as a criminal.
He thought he was facing a felony, quite honestly, but then when he talked to his attorney, they found out the charge had already been dropped to a misdemeanor.
Right.
But he had turned in the evidence already, so it's like, okay, tra-la-la, here we go.
Yeah. Well, it's been a fascinating interview. Thank you so much, Rod, for talking about the murder of Kelsey Barrett, a shocking true crime story. For those that might want to find out more about this story, do you have a website? Is there an Amazon page you might want to look at?
It's rodcackley.com, K-A-C-K-L-E-Y, rodcackley.com. That's the best place to go.
Okay, thank you so much, Rod. It's been an absolute pleasure. You have a great evening. Talk to you again soon. Good night.
Same to you, Dan. Thanks a lot.
Good night.